From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for May 7th, 2021. Your Milwaukee Bucks are home Saturday with the Rockets and Tuesday with Orlando. And speaking of Florida, the Brewers are in Miami for the weekend and then back home all next week. So let's start in Florida. The U.S. Post Office motto is, neither rain, sleet, or snow will keep us from our appointed rounds. But naked bodies at a senior nudist colony, well, that's a property line even the letter carriers won't cross. And they have a union. Too much technology can't be a problem. In Indonesia, a groom almost married the wrong woman. He got to the church just in time, but didn't recognize any of the guests or the wedding party. The problem was his GPS sent him to the wrong church. I personally would have taken that as a sign from God. Here's the truth. Nobody likes cockroaches, but a woman in India really doesn't like them. Her husband is divorcing her because of her cockroach phobia. Every time she sees a roach, they have to move. They've moved 18 times in the last 3 years. Apparently, he was okay with 18 moves, but 19 was one cockroach too many. In Bavaria, German police found a suspicious-looking object in the woods. Thinking it was a bomb, they took pictures of it and hoped that headquarters would help identify it. And they did. It wasn't a bomb, but a harmless sex toy. Those wacky Germans. And finally, if I could sell all the Legos I bought for my grandkids, I thought I could retire. But not once in 35 years has Bob Landis suggested I buy Legos as a retirement investment. I should have listened. On the podcast today, we have Brian Kill, Dave Sandstrom, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Max. A lot of pieces to a balanced portfolio. I'm not sure Legos are one of them. A good week overall for broad markets, although mixed for markets. The S&P 500 added 1.2% this week. That's 51 points to close at 42.32. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 902 points, up 2.7% this week to close at 34.776. But the NASDAQ down 1.5%. 210 points to close today at 13,752. For the year, the Dow now up 14.2%, the S&P up 13.2%, the NASDAQ trailing behind up 6.9%. A lot of news this week on the economy, a lot of news this week on the Treasury and the direction of interest rates. I found it interesting that earlier in the week, Janet Yellen, the former Fed chair and current Treasury secretary, came out potentially in favor of moving interest rates higher here. Now, that's no longer in her job description, but certainly some thoughts that if the economic recovery got too hot, we may have some cause for the Fed to move rates higher, for the Fed to potentially slow asset purchases. And then, Joel, today we got some news on the jobs report. And according to the Minneapolis Fed president, Neel Kashkari, I think he suggests we're still in a highly certain and uncertain environment and a long way to go. So let's not prematurely declare victory. And as you look at, I think, how quickly Yellen backed off some of those comments earlier Tuesday, as you look at the data that's been reported since, there's no easy way out of this. There's no easy end to this pandemic economy, and we saw that with the employment data this week.
Yeah, Cal, be careful of celebrating too soon. We always point out that the numbers that we get from month to month, you shouldn't put a lot of credence in them, but it's the bigger picture to look at. But the numbers that we got from the jobs report today showed that we continue adding jobs in April, but it was a quarter of what analysts were expecting. It was 266,000 jobs. They were expecting more like 1 million jobs. that we're going to have. It was a third of what we added. We had 777,000 jobs that we added in March. So it was a slowdown, but still we're making progress toward, getting back to where we were before the pandemic. That's still 8.2 million jobs. That's still a lot of jobs, and it's uneven. You know, it's more women are out of the workforce. There are, more leisure and hospitality workers were added in April, but we're still very far behind where we were a year ago. And they're still sorting out. We've talked about companies sort of using this pause of the pandemic to figure out what they're doing. I think a lot of workers are doing the same thing.
And the challenge that we have in terms of employment is that we still have a lot of jobs that are open right now. It seems like you can't drive down the road without seeing message boards or signs posted on windows saying that people are looking for help. And, I think a lot of reasons for that, certainly worth pointing out that some of the big ones are just finding childcare for a lot of workers. Still continued fears about, COVID-19, people getting sick. And then obviously, a big one that hangs out there is that we continue to have expanded unemployment benefits that may be forcing some of these employers to pay a little more than what they want to for workers right now. Add in skills mismatches, add in all kinds of other factors that might pile on to that. And you've got this weird situation, which isn't necessarily atypical of economic recoveries, but which is, I think, more pronounced right now, where there are plenty of people looking for work, plenty of jobs for those people, but you just can't seem to fill them quick enough to fill all those gaps.
You're right, Kyle. We've got all those sorts of different reasons of why, employers are having a hard time filling jobs in some instances. You talked about childcare and those sorts of things. And I saw that 64,000 fewer women were in the workforce in April than in March. So, women are the chief child providers in most families. And so that helps explain some of that. You've got wages, you've got healthcare, you've got all sorts of things. You've got those unemployment benefits and the supplements and the wages that people were making prior to the pandemic now what their prospects are afterward. I saw some research that the people at Pew Research did earlier this year, where they found 66% of unemployment people were seriously considering changing the field that they were in. So again, people are reconsidering what they were doing. So maybe they won't be going back to the same sorts of jobs that they had before.
Yeah, certainly workers are more mobile than they've ever been, whether that's geographically or whether that's, sector to sector. And I think, the pandemic has certainly escalated a trend that was developing for years. As you look at some of the other economic data that was out this week, Brian, I know one of the big ones you like to focus on is productivity, and in particular, what that means for, growth potential, what that means for again, how much work the individual can do. Productivity gains are a big sign that there's potential economic improvement coming, especially for the companies that are seeing those productivity gains.
Yeah, I think in the long run, productivity is one of the best ways to give the most people the most in terms of economic gain and whatnot. I think in the short run, though, it can be awfully misleading and pretty typical that when you come out of a period we've been of difficulty like we have, and we're kind of ramping back up again, that you'll get a jump in productivity, right? Demand kind of spikes before supply does, and people are forced to work a little harder, maybe to be a little bit more creative on how to get things done while they're ramping back up. But certainly, I think in the long run, when you consider some of the other demographic trends, if we're going to have fewer people or fewer people in the job force or however this plays out, to have fewer people do more work at the end still gets you to the same end game. So I think having really not had strong productivity numbers for a number of years now, that might be a pleasant surprise moving forward if indeed we're able to get better faster at some of the things we're doing right now.
And Brian, that gets back to what we were talking about before and we've talked about in past weeks about businesses just sort of figuring things out better and getting more productive and having more output, even though that they don't have the workers for it, or that the workers that they have are working less time. That's how productivity goes up.
Well, and you saw the opposite on the way down last year, you know, when things slow down, productivity drops like a rock. So, you know, some of this is to be expected. I think in the long run, though, we are in a very disruptive economy right now, and people are being forced to some degree to figure out better ways to do things. And, you know, the old, you know, being forced to figure it out is impetus enough sometimes, and gains in productivity may be the end result for that. So we'll see.
Just reiterating what Brian's point about the disruptive nature of the pandemic, and historically we've seen, you know, anything in a disruptive technology like the advent of the internet or computers, or in this case, a disruptive event like a pandemic, forcing companies to be more creative and actually pulling forward years of technology and advancements in their ideas into the present day. I think in a strange way, it becomes healthy to experience this kind of disruption once in a while.
You know, I think what's going to be fascinating for the next few months, because if you go back a year now, we've been anticipating the recovery, right? Are we going to get past COVID, and what's it going to look like when we come springing back? Well, we're in the early stages of that now. And you know, COVID, thankfully, I think, you know, perhaps not if you're in India right now, but for most of the rest of the world, seems to be something we're overcoming. And we're looking toward an economy that's showing some pretty incredible numbers, some corporate earnings growth that are pretty fantastic. But we're already now, we're in this transition, and we're starting to look ahead and see what's it going to look like when we aren't in transition and things settle down. And, you know, you start to, a number of articles about inflation, discussions about supply chain management. I mean, for God's sakes, we're short on chicken now, you know. How does that happen in a pandemic? But you're starting to now analyze whether things like productivity, or is that a temporary spike? Is that a long-term spike? Are some of these supply chain problems going to be just something that's solved in the next couple of months? And I think that's going to be the fascinating story over the next couple of months. Yeah, all these things are happening. We're going to feel a lot better. But where does it all shake out at the end of the day? And when it does shake out, you know, is there a net positive? And to what degree can we rely on that? And of course, you know, where is the impact on earnings, and how does that translate into market results? But I think we're kind of in the middle of that transition now. And so the fun will begin.
Joel, other economic data that stood out to you this week? I think one of the reports that I pay attention to as far as consumers is the, you know, auto sales number, motor vehicles being a fairly high dollar purchase for consumers, and mostly positive news there.
Yeah, that was a big deal, actually. In April, the U.S. sold 18.5 million cars and light trucks. So that includes SUVs. That's on an annual rate, and that's the highest it's ever been. In, I don't know, they've got like 45 years of data, the Fed does, and that was the highest, 18.5 million. Compare that to a year ago in April, and that was 8.7 million a year ago, and that's the lowest ever in those 45 years. So you know, we talk about how consumers drive 60-70% of the economy, and you're right, these auto sales are a good sign that people are wanting to spend more. Now, again, getting back to Brian's point, you know, how much of an anomaly is that? And we also know that, you know, there have been production constraints on automakers because of chips. So, you know, some of that's going to be slowing down, and some people are going to be disappointed because they can't get the cars that they want, and the prices are going to go up. So that's, again, hitting at inflation.
You know, I think that inflation conversation is the one that we've danced around for a very long time. I think Yellen was as direct as we're going to hear from any past or current member of the Fed as far as kind of what the intentions need to be if we do see the economy start to overheat. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, Yellen did back away from those statements fairly quickly, but the market responded pretty swiftly. Yeah, and when you look at the fact that we're in the midst of earnings seasons, now 87%, almost 90% through earnings season, when you look at the fact that we're nearly double what expectations were, and yet, you know, some of the stocks that have had the best earnings numbers, have taken a step back in some cases. I know, Brian, you pointed out a few of the bigger tech names last week that had some trouble, despite the fact that, you know, they were handily beating those expectations and expectations that were fairly robust. I think it's clear that the Fed is the thing that so many of us are paying attention to and response to potential signs of inflation. You know, the thing that seems to be keeping things in check. You look this week at just the difference between the S&P and the NASDAQ as just one example of how growth is being discounted more now than it had been for quite a while. And so I think, you know, certainly as we look at the road ahead, what the Fed does, what happens to interest rates matters more now than it has in a very long time.
Well, and I think it's a really good example of what we were just talking about in terms of, you know, we got our earnings. Oh, they were great. You know, we expected them to be great. And already people are like, well, yeah, but what about a year from now? You know, how does this translate into where Apple is a year from now or where Microsoft is a year from now? Because we already paid up the stock to take advantage of those earnings, you know? And then I think when it comes back to Janet Yellen, I think she did Chairman Powell a huge favor by kind of pricking that bubble by being the first person to kind of go out there and go, oh, inflation, you know, kind of mention ever so quietly that it's a word we maybe ought to at least be talking about a little bit. And certainly I think if it was a narrative of the Fed, it would have caused even a whole lot more, you know, turbulence in the markets for those couple of days. So, you know, pretty easy for her to throw that out there and then the next day kind of soften her discussion a little bit. But I think in the long run, just getting that conversation out there for everybody to sort of be aware of was actually a huge favor she did for Chairman Powell and the Fed.
And we had a large short-term debt auction on Thursday of this week, and that debt went for essentially 0%. That has more to do with investors chasing yield on the shortest end of the yield curve than it does any expectation for the future. But when you look at what happened today with the 10-year Treasury, as soon as that jobs number came out, we saw a huge drop in the 10-year Treasury. And then I think as investors started to digest, they realized, okay, this really doesn't change all that much about what our outlook is. The yield on the 10-year Treasury quickly recovered back to where it had been, settling a little above 1.5 for a while. You know, I think the market has been clear about what is to come in terms of inflation, in terms of growth expectations. That early rally in Treasuries at the start of this year was a sign that growth was going to pick up, was a sign that there are some transitory signs of inflation, but maybe not long-term inflation pressure just yet. It doesn't mean it can't materialize. It certainly, however, means that at least the way we're going right now, we can digest some of the transitory stuff. That also doesn't mean you're not going to see some headline prints for CPI or for PCE that show inflation in the next couple of months. Because, you know, as you pointed out earlier, chickens are scarce right now. If you look at any of the fast food joints that are buying chicken, they're talking about 60 to 100% year-over-year increases in the cost of those inputs. And so those are real costs that are going to be passed on to consumers. We've seen it in the price of lumber that's up to two or threefold. But again, I think, you know, it's just a reminder to investors that interest rates matter, that earnings are an important piece of the puzzle, certainly, that valuations, though, depend not just on the earnings piece, but also on the interest rate piece.
And Kyle, to go along with that point, I mean, we need to take a step back here and look at the unprecedented, you know, territory we're in as it relates to stimulus. I mean, I think when you put you look back and say, okay, we have an economy here in the United States that is, you know, the GDP at $21 trillion, okay? That's the sum of all the goods and services that we produce as a country. And within 18 months, we've literally flooded the economy with another $5 to $7 trillion in cash. So you're talking about adding 30% of our total output in cash into the system. Yeah, we're going to see some disruptions here. You're going to see some threats of inflation. You're going to see some shortages. And, you know, that this is kind of uncharted. So it's going to be very interesting to see the impact of that stimulus, how long it lasts, how quickly it peaks. I mean, all those things that we can't answer right now that I think are going to be fascinating to watch.
The whole point too is we don't know. I mean, there's a lot of history. There's a lot to study, you know, and I think there's, you know, a lot of smart people that are kind of putting the pieces together, but the world keeps changing. And I think our job is not so much to predict what's going to happen. Our job is to be aware potentially of what may happen in a number of different areas. And again, you know, building portfolios to enhance return as much as we can relative to the risks and probability of things going wrong. But I think it's really healthy to have a conversation about inflation because, you know, if it's a one in a million chance that it's going to be long term, we ought to be aware of it. We ought to be looking out for it because that's our job, you know. And I do think there are enough factors in play right now. You know, if there's a shortage of labor and that gives labor the chance to raise their wages and salaries, you know, that contributes to inflation. And if there's a shortage of goods, that contributes to inflation. It's easy enough to say these things will be gone in 6 months, but maybe they won't. So let's keep our eyes open for it and factor it into our thought process as we move forward and kind of keep our eyes on both ends of things, you know?
It is amazing how well all those conversations fit together, how well, you know, I think that potentially drives future returns for stocks as well. Yeah, rates moving a little higher because of overheating growth is a challenge, but overheating growth also benefits the flip side of that, which is, you know, stock prices can go up because earnings have gone up because corporations can charge more. And so I think I'm encouraged by the balanced approach and what that means for the range of outcomes that we can reasonably expect, whether that's you know, inflation ticks for a little while and then settles back down, or whether a little more inflation is here to stay. You know, I think, you know, you rightfully point out, it's not our job to try to figure out which of those is the right scenario. Our job is to try to figure out, okay, how can we navigate the range of potential outcomes here?
Well, and I think there's so much we don't know still too. I think to your point, Dave, about, you know, $6 trillion, well, four and a half of it, we aren't there yet, right? So we don't really know what we're going to spend it on, and we really don't know how we're going to pay for it. And $4.5 trillion of additional debt is a completely different situation for inflation if it's $4.5 trillion paid by higher taxes or something else, you know. So even when we're talking about things we know, we don't really even know those. So you know, back to my, I think the next 6 months are going to be fascinating because there's a lot of moving pieces right now that may either, you know, help some of these things along or hinder some of these things and cause other things to be bigger or lesser problems, and kind of the challenge and also the fun of the job we do as things kind of move from week to week and month to month and year to year.
Which gets back to Neel Kashkari's statement earlier today. This is a highly uncertain environment that we're in. I think says about all you need to know right now. Dave, you know, longer-term planning is one of the things that we like to do for the vast majority of our clients. The challenge, of course, is that by the time we get to many of those clients, they're at or near retirement, and it can be a little late by then to right the ship if they're pointed in the wrong direction. You had an interesting conversation this week, though, with the younger side of our client base and talking about maybe how you get started. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, Kyle, it's very refreshing. I had an opportunity to speak with a grandson of a client of mine, a 19-year-old young man, who's already asking those questions about how you properly start to save and what are some of the disciplines that he could put into play and to really start thinking about how to take care of himself long term. And, you know, unfortunately, we hear a lot of negative stories about millennial generations and, you know, spend for today, forget about tomorrow. But it's very refreshing when I get the opportunity to talk to somebody who's thinking along those lines. And then it also reminds me to, you know, maybe we need to promote a little bit more to our existing clientele. Reach out to those young people in your lives, you know, whether it's your kids or your grandkids or nieces, nephews, whatever it is, and have those conversations about, hey, sit down and think about the future here a little bit. Get yourself into some pretty habits early on. Put some of that money away before you even recognize that it's yours in your account, and be disciplined to at least have those conversations. So that was just a nice, refreshing conversation to have. Kind of brought me back to really the core strength of investing, and that is having time on your side, right? And having a long horizon in front of you. So it was really a nice conversation to have.
Dave, do those conversations come a little easier through virtual meetings too? I mean, is that how this happened? I can imagine that if you're meeting with somebody over the phone or over Zoom, for instance, that it's kind of easier to include other members of the family.
Yeah. And this was a phone conversation. So it did kind of flow quite nicely and segue into those types of conversations. So again, I just was nice to have that talk about a young person really taking control of their future.
Dave inserted himself into a video game while I was in the middle of, sorry, that was terrible. wasn't it Einstein that said compound interest was the eighth wonder of the world, right? Just start early. The math's in your favor, right?
Yeah, I think I'm fond of talking to especially younger clients about focusing on those things we can control. We can't control the returns we get. We know that with time they should be there, but there's lots of variables at play there. But you can control how much you save or how much you can save and when you're saving it. And the earlier you start and the more that you put away, the more that eighth wonder of the world is going to work its magic and get you, to a far better place far sooner than what you had expected. And so I think, we try to encourage, especially our older clients, to get their children, their grandchildren, even sometimes great-grandchildren involved in those conversations. The ones that seem to understand it are the ones who have heard it from multiple family members, from multiple people that they love, and who have been given an interest in it early on. I've got a set of sisters that are clients of mine and whose parents and grandparents have been clients of the firm for a very long time. And grandma and grandpa were the ones who early on in these girls' lives said, hey, you should be interested in this. Here's something that I'm going to get for you, something that I'm going to put in your account that you might want to keep an eye on. And it got both of them, I think, dialed into what it means to be an investor. It got both of them dialed into the power of investing and what you can potentially do if you save early, if you save often. So such a great message. And again, maybe misses the mark for those that are close to or in retirement, but that doesn't mean it's too late to help those in your lives that you love. Well, as always, we enjoy doing the program for you. We will talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.